Well, good morning, everyone. Please do turn back with me in your Bibles to Luke chapter 23. And as we look at these familiar to many of us and yet truly profound verses, I want to see three ironies that Luke highlights that help us grasp the immensity of what is taking place and therefore what it looks like for us to respond appropriately. Firstly, we see that Jesus, who is mocked as king, is the king. Secondly, we see Jesus, who is innocent, suffers in the place of the guilty. And thirdly, Jesus calls his followers to die in order to live. So let's think about the first irony. Jesus, who is mocked as king, is the king. The religious leaders, they are fueled by hatred and jealousy. They are determined to kill Jesus. So look at the question they ask him. Verse 67, if you are the Messiah, tell us. And now, of course, they don't believe for a second that Jesus is God's promised rescuing king. Otherwise, they wouldn't have shamefully have arrested and beaten him. They're simply trying to make Jesus incriminate himself. But of course, they don't have the authority to issue the death sentence. So they drag Jesus before Pilate, the Roman governor, with all sorts of spurious charges levelled against him. Look at the question that Pilate asked Jesus there in verse 3. Are you the king of the Jews? You kind of get the feeling that Pilate's question to Jesus, it's dripping with irony, because it certainly doesn't appear as though Jesus is a king. He's bruised and bleeding. He's bound. He's covered in spit. He appears so weak and helpless. He's alone. There's no great army behind him. The idea that Jesus is a king and therefore poses a threat to Pilate, well, it seems utterly ridiculous. He finds absolutely no basis for this charge, but he tries to pass a buck by handing him over to King Herod. So look at verse 8. When Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased because for a long time he had been wanting to see him. From what he had heard about him, he hoped to see him perform some sort of sign. He plied him with many questions, but Jesus gave him no answer. Herod has clearly heard a lot about Jesus. He views him as little more than a party magician who can provide him with some light entertainment. And when Jesus refuses to play Herod's game, indeed, or say anything to him, Herod and his men respond by ridiculing Jesus. They mock his claim as a king. They dress him up like a king. They conclude that any notion that Jesus is a king, well, it is a complete joke. We know from the other gospel accounts that the Roman soldiers do something similar. They thrust a crown of thorns on Jesus' head. They mockingly bow down before him, chanting, "Hail, King of the Jews." And of course, they think they're being ironic. Let's expose this fraud king. But Luke, he wants us to see the double irony that is going on. Because the reality is, they speak and act better than they know. Because Jesus really is the king. Not just of the Jews, but he is the king of the whole world. He is the king of heaven and earth. Therefore, everyone should rightfully bow down before him. And of course, this is what Luke has been demonstrating right the way through his gospel. He piles up evidence revealing that Jesus really is the long-awaited Messiah. He really is the Son of God. As he heals the sick, as he controls the forces of nature, as he forgives sin, as he drives out demons, as he raises the dead. All of these bear witness to the fact that Jesus really is God's promised rescuing king. And Jesus himself testifies to this in verse 69. Notice the religious leaders ask him, "If you are the Messiah, tell us." Jesus answered, "If I tell you, you will not believe me. And if I ask you, you would not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty gods." As Jesus stands trial before the religious leaders, he wants them to be in no doubt whatsoever as to who it is they are convicting. Jesus is the Son of Man, spoken in the Old Testament book of Daniel, this divine and human figure who has all power and authority, who will one day be worshipped by all nations and rule over a kingdom that will never end. Jesus wants them to know that his reign is not merely national nor even global. Instead, it is universal. Therefore, he really is the rightful king over the religious leaders, over Pilate, over Herod, over the soldiers, and over the crowd who all mock him, even if they don't realize it. He is the king that they are accountable to. Notice the irony when the religious leaders think that Jesus is answerable to them, but really they are answerable to him. He is their true sovereign, because they will see Jesus again, but it will be in another court, the heavenly courtroom. And this time they will be in the dock. But tragically, they do not heed Jesus's loving warning. If you were a bystander watching Jesus's trial unfold, Jesus would appear like a helpless victim as he passed from the corrupt religious leaders to the powerful Roman governor, to the vindictive puppet king, to the enraged mob, and finally to the sadistic military death squad. But despite how it initially appears, in fact, Jesus is the one in control. He chooses to willingly stand quiet. He chooses not to defend himself or refute the false charges that for sure would have allowed him to walk free. He chooses not to call down legions of angels. He chooses not to perform a miracle demonstrating that he's not just the king of the Jews, but the king of the whole world. You see, in these verses, Jesus, he is not resigned to die, but he is resolved to die. He deliberately heads to the cross, not suicidally, but sacrificially. His life is not taken from him. Instead, he willingly lays it down. And so as the religious leaders, as the soldiers and the crowd carry out this appalling torture and abuse of Jesus, all they end up doing is fulfilling exactly what the Old Testament predicted would happen to the anointed king, to the Messiah. Falsely accused, yet remaining silent. Beaten and mocked. The kings of the earth banding together against the Lord's anointed. Executed with common criminals. Hands and feet pierced. Clothes divided. Every detail that happens to Jesus is so clearly predicted in advance. And so it confirms that Jesus really is God's chosen, rescuing king. Yes, Jesus is a king. And yes, he will establish his everlasting kingdom, but not through political skill, not through military might, but through his death on a cross. So here's the first irony. Jesus, who is mocked as king, really is the king. The king of heaven and earth, the king that we are all accountable to. Here's the second irony. Jesus, who is innocent, suffers in the place of the guilty. Did you notice, as Dawn read these verses, how many times Pilate declares that Jesus is innocent? At verse 4, Pilate announced to the chief priests and the crowd, "I find no basis for a charge against this man." After Pilate sends him to Jesus to Herod, look at his verdict, verse 13. Pilate called together the chief priests, the rulers of the people, and said to them, "You brought me this man as one who has incited the people to rebellion. I have examined him in your presence and have found no basis for your charges against him. Neither has Herod, for he has sent him back to us. As you can see, he has done nothing to deserve death." And when the crowd call for Barabbas to be released and instead Jesus to be crucified, look at how Pilate responds. It's there in verse 22. "Why? What crime has he committed? I have found no grounds for the death penalty." Now, we know from other historical sources that Pilate was known for being a ruthless governor of occupied Israel. He would have had no problems dispatching people if it suited his own political goals. But even Pilate recognizes that Jesus has done absolutely nothing deserving the awful sentence and punishment that awaits him. So we have one prisoner, Jesus, who is entirely innocent. But by way of contrast, Luke introduces us to another prisoner, Barabbas. He's clearly an infamous prisoner. In verse 19, Luke tells us that he's guilty of starting insurrection and murder. Barabbas, he is a dangerous criminal. He is as guilty as you can get. He deserves the sentence he is just about to face. But as we read these verses, Luke wants you and I to appreciate that spiritually, we are just like Barabbas. We find ourselves in a very similar position to that infamous condemned criminal that first Good Friday. You see, like Barabbas, we are all guilty of treason. Not against the state, but cosmic treason against our Creator. We see something of our default attitude to God from the shouts of the crowd. Look at verse 20. "Away with this man." At verse 21, "Crucify him, crucify him." At verse 23, with loud shouts, they insistently demanded that Jesus be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. You see, the howling hatred of the crowd reveals something of our natural heart attitude towards God. You see, as humans, we can't simply be neutral towards God. But we were created to know and enjoy him, to obey and worship him, to be satisfied in him alone. But we've rebelled against him. We've looked for fulfillment in other places. We've done what seemed right to us rather than what God has told us is right. We won't surrender the throne of our lives to anyone, not even our loving Creator. And so we are God's enemies. We're rebels against him, and he is a threat to our way of life. Every time we reject Jesus' loving rule over our lives, we're effectively saying that we wish that he didn't exist, that he were dead. We all have divine blood on our hands. If you're an art lover, you may know the famous painting by Rembrandt called The Raising of the Cross. In the painting, Rembrandt doesn't simply depict Jesus being crucified, but at the foot of the cross, Rembrandt paints himself as one of the soldiers involved in the execution. Rembrandt recognized that he himself was responsible for crucifying the Lord of glory. And so, like Barabbas, like the baying mob, by nature we all stand guilty before God. We're on death row, helplessly awaiting the day when we will face the death and the sentence that God has declared for our treason against him. No way of being able to atone for our crimes, no way of being able to rescue ourselves, no way of being able to free ourselves from the power and the penalty of sin. Friends, just put yourself in Barabbas' shoes for a moment. You're languishing in a Roman jail awaiting your death. You know you will be crucified for your crimes. And in moments of honesty, you know you deserve it. And so day after day, you sit in the jail cell, awaiting the terrible fate that will soon come upon you. The beatings, the nails, the mockery, the excruciating pain, the blood slowly filling your lungs, the breaking of your legs. That is your future. An incredibly bleak and dark future. You don't know when the day is coming. You just know that it's coming. And then on this fateful day, you hear a mob outside. It sounds as though this fateful day has finally come. You can hear the crowd screaming, "Crucify him. Crucify him." The cell door is banged open. The Roman guards roughly drag you out in front of the angry crowd, the baying mob. And then, amazingly, you are completely set free. Just like that. You've not done anything to deserve it. You've not been able to atone for your crimes in any way. And yet now you've been gloriously set free, no longer to face the terrible punishment that you deserve. And as you stand there, both full of relief but confusion, you watch another man, bruised and bleeding, stumbling under the weight of a cross. A cross that should be your own. You've been pardoned and set free because this man is going to be punished and killed in your place. Luke wants us to understand that the innocent dies in the place of the guilty. Wonderfully, Jesus, he heads to the cross in our place. He carries the cross that we should rightly carry. He takes a punishment that we deserve. He dies a death that we should experience. Why? So we might receive forgiveness and freedom and everlasting life with God that he alone deserved. Jesus, the innocent one, is condemned as a sinner and suffers in the place of a guilty. And the third irony is this, that Jesus calls his followers to die in order to live. In verse 26, we're introduced to Simon. He's press ganged by the execution squad into carrying Jesus' cross. Other passages in the New Testament seem to suggest that Simon eventually became a disciple of Jesus. But of course, every follower of Jesus is a bit like Simon. Why? Because we're all called to carry our cross and follow Jesus. Turn back with me a few pages in your Bibles to Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9, that's on page 1039. Luke chapter 9, let me read from verse 23. Jesus says, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross daily and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me will save it." I think it's fair to say we struggle to appreciate the radical nature of Jesus' call because we have a very sanitized view of the cross. It's a piece of jewelry. It's an image on a church building. But in the first century, the cross was an object of humiliation. It was a sign that you had been utterly rejected by the world. If you saw someone carrying a cross, they were a dead man walking. They were on a one-way trip to death. We easily miss the force of Jesus' words because taking up your cross, well, it's entered the English language as an idiom for doing anything moderately unpleasant. Putting out the bins, kissing great Aunt Edna or whatever else it might be. But Jesus, he's calling his followers to come and die. To identify with him in his humiliation and rejection by the world. To identify with him in his death. Dying to self-centeredness. Dying to self-rule. And instead living only for King Jesus. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a German pastor who was executed by the Nazis because of his obedience to King Jesus. He once said, "When Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die." This is what one of Bonhoeffer's friends wrote about him after his death. If we ask why Bonhoeffer had the courage to be martyred, we can only answer that he died many times before he was hanged at the concentration camp in Flossenbürg. He was passionately convinced that discipleship meant death. Death to our own comforts. Death to our own agendas. And where necessary, physical death too. Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves, take up their cross daily, and follow me. I wonder, what will this look like for you? Perhaps there's a particular persistent sinful behaviour or attitude to address. Picking up your cross is simply taking radical steps in repentance. It's walking in obedience. It's grabbing the hammer and nails and taking your cherished sin and nailing it to the cross. Perhaps it means informing school friends or work colleagues that you're a Christian, if you haven't already done so, even if they think you're weird as a result. It might mean standing firm on a particular ethical or moral decision, because when you do, you know you'll be labelled as bigoted or intolerant. Picking up the cross means bearing the reproach that Jesus endured, doing what is right rather than what is popular. Perhaps taking the initiative to forgive someone, to seek restoration,
even though it might be an incredibly painful thing to do, and it is entirely undeserved. Perhaps you've got a really difficult spouse or family member. They're ungrateful, unfair, unreasonable. And so picking up your cross means not clinging to your rights, but continuing to selflessly love and care for them, even when you receive no thanks or appreciation. Perhaps there's a particular comfort to forgo in order to sacrificially serve in the church family. Perhaps at this point you're thinking, is Jesus's costly, all-demanding call really worth it? But did you notice the paradox, the irony of Jesus's words? The call to take up our cross is a call to come and die and live. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will save it. In God's economy, losing one's life for Jesus is actually the path to everlasting life with Jesus. Of course, there will be days when taking up our cross and following the way of Jesus, the way of wholehearted obedience, denying ourselves, identifying with him in his rejection by the world, humbly serving others, doing what is right rather than what is easy or popular, being quick to forgive, putting the interests of others ahead of our own. There will be days when denying ourselves, taking up our cross and following the way of Jesus seems too hard and too costly. But we mustn't forget that any sacrifice we're called to make for Jesus pales into insignificance compared with the immensity of the sacrifice that Jesus has first made for us. And so in those moments when we find ourselves struggling to take up our cross, the answer is not to look in and try harder. Instead, we're to look up to Jesus and remember that he first carried our cross. We belong to Jesus now, and so we're to live for him. And the Lord who was humbled, the Lord who humbled himself for us, was exalted. And so we walk the way of the cross. Yes, a road that is hard and costly. But friends, do you see where the road is going? It leads to glory. And we walk the way of the cross sustained by the sure and certain hope of coming glory. One day we will stand before Jesus' throne in a world made new, and we will hear the words, "Well done, good and faithful servant." And then we'll see that everything we did for him, every cost, was supremely worth it. Jesus, who is mocked as king, really is the King of heaven and earth. Jesus, the innocent one, suffers in the place of the guilty in our place. And Jesus calls his followers to come and die and live.